Good morning, and welcome to the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm your host, Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico. Public Health New Mexico is a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. The recent brutal murders of two Navajo men in Albuquerque have brought questions about homelessness in New Mexico into the national spotlight. What is the reality of homelessness in our state, and what policy and social changes are needed to improve the situation? Joining us this morning to talk about homelessness, poverty, and health are Lisa Uvall, Policy and Advocacy Director at the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, and Dr. Janet Page Reeves, Research Assistant Professor in the Office of Community Health in the UNM Family and Community Medicine Department. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And we'll be joined later in the program over the phone by Rick Abasta. He's the Communications Director for the Navajo Nation. So, Lisa, your organization works with homeless services and homeless service agencies across the state. Can you talk a little bit about how many people are homeless in New Mexico?
Sure. That's usually the first question that people ask me, and also a difficult one to answer. We estimate that on any given night in New Mexico, about 3,000 people are experiencing homelessness, meaning that they are sleeping outside, in shelter, or in temporary transitional housing. However, we know that's really just a minimum count and is really an undercount of how many people are homeless. One, because it's hard to count people that are sleeping outside, and also because it doesn't include the many families and unaccompanied youth that are staying in motels or are doubled up with family and friends and, you know, sleep couch surfing, sleeping on a different couch every night. So that's our best number, but it's definitely a minimum estimate.
And you said about 3,000. How many of those are in Albuquerque? Is Albuquerque kind of the most populous hub of homelessness that we have in the state?
Actually, about 1,200 of those folks are in Albuquerque, and then the rest are in other areas throughout the state.
You said it's difficult. How do we count them? How do we get these numbers?
Well, what we do every other year, the coalition coordinates what's called the point in time count, which is when we try to count the number of people that are homeless on one night in the state. Part of it is just contacting emergency and transitional housing providers and asking how many people stayed there on that night. And then we also want to count people that were unsheltered. So we, depending on the area, sometimes we organize people to actually go out in the streets and try to find people that are sleeping outside. We'll also go to service sites like soup kitchens and drop-in shelters and survey people to find out where they slept on the night of the point-in-time count.
Who do you think you might be missing, though? I mean, you said it's difficult. You're just going out kind of surveying the streets. So when you talk about homeless, that, you know, the 3,000 per night, that is just people that are on the streets. That seems to be maybe an underestimation of the entire issue of homelessness here. Does that jive with you?
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, partly we conduct our point-in-time count in that way because we're required to conduct a point-in-time count by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, and those are their specific rules for how to count it. HUD doesn't consider people that are couch surfing or staying in motels because they can't collect the resources to pay for an apartment. HUD doesn't consider those folks homeless, so they're not included in our point-in-time count. But we do consider, I mean, the coalition considers those folks homeless, as does other federal institutions like the Department of Education, because really those people are also living without a safe, stable, permanent situation. So we also consider that to be homeless.
How many people would you say are in that kind of situation?
You know, that's actually a very difficult question. I would say, I mean, one number that we do have is the Albuquerque Public Schools Title I homeless programs serves homeless kids that are in the public school system. And I believe during the last academic school year, they served over 6,000 homeless kids. And those are kids over the age of six who are in school, so it doesn't even include their siblings or other kids who are under the age of six. So I would say, you know, over the course, and that's also over the course of a year, not just on a single night. But I would say, you know, over the course of the year, there's really thousands of people that experience homelessness in one form or another in Albuquerque.
So your website, the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, the website says that 17,000 New Mexicans are homeless for at least part of the year every year.
That's our
best
estimate.
Large number.
Yes.
Janet Page Reeves, you write about the invisibility of homelessness and hunger in New Mexico. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that it's very like Lisa was saying. If you're sleeping on somebody's, if you become homeless, and you end up living on your sister-in-law's couch, nobody's counting you. Nobody knows about that. And because the issue of homelessness or the issue of hunger are things that are in our society very shameful. People don't want other people to know, so they go to great lengths to cover up the fact that they're homeless. So you may be interacting with somebody who actually doesn't have a home, and you might not know it because, I mean, usually even at school, some of the things that give kids away are if they come in rumpled clothes, if they're, I mean, so they start to seem disheveled because they don't have facilities to be able to take proper care of themselves. And a lot of times a teacher will start to notice, but it's not something that people will scream in the streets, "Hey, everybody, look at me, I'm homeless." It's not like that. People try to cover it up.
So this stigma that's attached to it, does that have an effect on people trying to get services? If you're afraid to admit that you're homeless because you're afraid of the judgments that people might have against you, I mean, what kind of effect does that have on your, you know, access to health services, to food services?
Well, in the food realm, a lot of people do feel a stigma, and therefore they don't want to access benefits like food stamps. Sometimes people will access food pantry food before they'll access food stamps because they don't want to be seen as people on welfare. They see that because our society, we've so stigmatized that concept. And if you go to a food pantry, especially if it's at a church or something, it just seems like, oh, that's a little bit of help for me right now while I'm in need. So people can kind of legitimize it differently in their head, or they can go and help distribute the food at the food pantry, maybe if they're affiliated with the church, and therefore they can work a little bit and make it more acceptable for themselves to accept the food because then they're working a little bit to get the food. Lisa, I don't know if how stigma might affect people applying for homeless specific homeless resources.
I think there is a stigma around homelessness. So especially for, I think, individuals or families that are experiencing homelessness or at imminent risk of homelessness for the first time, that it can be difficult to seek out help. I think there's another piece, though, which is that resources to help folks that are homeless or at risk of homelessness are also very limited in our community, so that when people do try to find help, it can often be very frustrating and hopeless experience because they'll make a lot of calls looking for some assistance, and it's not available. A lot of the programs we have are doing great work, but they're often at capacity.
And I think another thing is so many people don't know where to turn for resources. So people that maybe have been living at the level of poverty for so long that maybe they and their family members may be aware of some of the resources that are out there. But in this economy that we have, a lot of people who previously were living above, you know, brutal poverty, they had a job, they had some income, but now a lot of people have lost their jobs or they've had some kind of crisis. And so people that previously weren't experiencing that type of poverty have fallen into poverty, and a lot of those people don't know anything about the resources, about where to go for those things.
I think that's true. In some ways, we are seeing a new face of homelessness in our state across the country because of the recession, which I feel like we're still not fully recovered from here in New Mexico. You know, the standard is that households should not have to pay more than 30% of their income towards rent. And yet we do have thousands and thousands of households in New Mexico that pay more than that towards rent. I think before the recession, they were just able to make it. They were able to maintain housing. But then as household members, wage earners, lost jobs or got their hours cut, they were no longer able to make the rent and were experiencing homelessness for the first time. So I agree with Janet that there are many folks out there that this is the first time they're facing this and they're not quite sure where to access help.
We're not out of the recession yet, but in New Mexico isn't doing as well as other states, but we're certainly not in the depths of it that we were several years ago. Are the numbers of homeless residents here doing a little bit better? How are we now, you know, in a kind of a timeline?
That's an interesting question. We conduct this point in time count every other year. We did see a decrease between 2013 and 2011, which seemed to indicate it's always hard to know exactly why the numbers change. But some possible factors are there was a decrease as the economy got better, that less people were experiencing homelessness. In Albuquerque, we also have an initiative called the Albuquerque Heading Home Initiative, which is specifically focused on getting folks that are chronically homeless and medically vulnerable off the streets and into housing. So that might be part of the impact as well. However, like I was saying earlier, it's really hard for those point in time count numbers to tell the full story because they don't capture a lot of the families that are doubled up or staying in motels. So our stats show one thing, but the stories that we hear from our members that are providing direct services, those stories indicate that there is still a continued increased demand for services and housing.
Right. And I should clarify, I said we might still be in the recession. The recession may be over, but we in New Mexico are, you know, are still recovering. You talked a little bit about this, but what are some of the health issues that homelessness causes?
So for folks that are living on the streets, that leaves them highly vulnerable to health issues. So that can include, let me give an example. If someone has a heart condition and they need to take medication on a regular basis to control that condition, that can be very hard to do when you're sleeping outside or in a shelter. You may not have a safe place to store your medication. Maybe you're supposed to take it with food, but you don't necessarily have control over when you eat, so that might not always be an option. Of course, just living outside in the elements can be very difficult on people's health. Cold in the winter, extreme heat in the summer. And as we know from recent events in Albuquerque, people that are homeless are also highly vulnerable to violence. And that is really a reality for folks that are living on the streets. But I also want to stress that there's also health concerns for families with children that might not be literally sleeping on the streets, but are couch surfing or staying in motels. There's a lot of evidence, and Janet may be able to speak to this, that for kids, not having a safe, permanent, stable place to live can affect both their emotional and physical health. And I don't know, Janet, if you have anything specific to add to that.
One of the things that I was wanting to add was when you think about people couch surfing, that means that they're living in a very transient kind of lifestyle. So maybe if I come to you and I say, you're my friend or my family member or something, and I say, I've lost my housing situation or we really need a place to stay. Do you think we could stay with you? So I come with my three small children and I live on your couch. That's going to get old for you pretty quickly. So, depending on the relationship that we have in terms of family connection or friendship, I'm quickly using up my social capital with you. So what that means is at some point you're going to ask me to leave or make it clear that I need to leave, or maybe I'll just feel compelled that I should probably leave. So then I go and stay on Lisa's couch and I use that social capital up. So I'm using up my social capital in a way that means that then when I need something else, I can't go back to you and ask for it. And social capital is so important to people who are living at that level of poverty. And then on top of that, think of this. If your kid's at a school and then you're transient and you lose your housing situation because you can't pay the rent or whatever and you're sleeping on somebody's couch, and then you go and you end up going on the west side, you're starting off, you're over here, you're in the International District, and then you end up in the South Valley with another family member, well, then your kid starts going to school there. Well, that transience dramatically impacts their educational outcomes. They're not staying with the same teacher. They're not learning the same thing. The whole classroom is affected when kids are transient, because what happens in Albuquerque is that kids are coming and going from classrooms all the time because of this poverty and transience, and it impacts the educational dynamic in the whole classroom. If you're the teacher and you're given 25 students at the beginning of the year, but at the end of the year only 12 of those are the same students that you had, and during the year you've had this filter of other kids coming in and out, that affects every kid in the classroom and the whole classroom dynamic. And then there are the emotional consequences that Lisa was talking about of what transience and that kind of insecurity about where you'll live, which is such a basic thing, means for kids as they're growing up. It's like a basic personal need.
Big issues that a lot of us don't think about on a day-to-day basis, but maybe now's the time to give it some more attention. It's 8:19, and you're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show. We're talking about homelessness in New Mexico with UNM Professor Janet Page Reeves and Lisa Uvall of the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. We want to hear from you and the audience. Have you ever been homeless or felt like it was a possibility? Why do you think homelessness is such a big problem in New Mexico? You can call our local number at 277-5866. Toll-free number is 877-899-5866. You can also send us an email at callinshow@kunm.org or post comments to our webpage. That's kunm.org. We're going to take a short break here, then we'll be back to take your calls.
Support provided by New Mexico Educators Federal Credit Union, where increased member participation in their not-for-profit financial cooperative has increased benefits. For a financial calculator and member benefit details, go to nmefcu.org.
Not until they realize the fragility of lives being taken from a bottle of beer and wine. A few seconds to leave behind while they wait for an entire time to speculate what they've done. And here is the families from the sons and daughters they stole cry. They're lost in their minds of what's wrong and what's right, and they're filled with excitement, still innocent inside. When they walk through a door promising a night that will be something to remember, not the one to end their lives or label out DWI.
Listen to Youth Media Project's Audio Revolution this Friday at 8 a.m. on KUNM 89.9 FM.
This is KUNM 89.9, broadcasting from the University of New Mexico. I'm Ed Williams. We're back talking about homelessness in New Mexico. If you want to weigh in or ask a question of our panel, the number is 277-5866 locally in Albuquerque. Toll free, 877-899-5866. Send us a tweet at KUNM Health. And we do have a Twitter question on the issue of education that we were just talking about before the break. Katie Stone asks, Albuquerque Public Schools say they have more than 3,000 homeless children in their system. How does this jive with earlier estimates?
So I was providing an estimate that I, from memory, that I had thought I had recently gotten from Albuquerque Public School System. So it may be that this person has a more has a better estimate. I had thought the number was closer to 6,000 over the last couple of years. But I could be wrong.
I thought that too, so I don't know either.
All right. Well, let's go to a phone call right now. Sarah is on the line from Albuquerque. Sarah, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Let me just get off the phone.
That's better.
Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for this really very important topic, because I just, we're talking about homeless children, and it's an awful issue. But I just want to also mention, like, the homeless young women. And these a lot of these homeless young women, they become victims and prey to the pimps that are prowling around looking for them and force them into sex slavery, human trafficking. And, you know, we all are aware of those the 9 murder victims on the west side. And many of them were seen at St. Martin's and Noonday and these homeless shelters and rescue missions. And I'm pretty sure a pimp got a hold of them. And so, and many of those girls were runaways from Oklahoma, and they're top preys to these pimps. And so, could I share you my personal experience? I used to be a homeless woman. And I used to have pimps come after me, and one of them pimp raped me, and they were going to force me into prostitution, and I don't know how I managed to survive it. So this is a huge issue, and I know that human trafficking has been getting a lot of attention all throughout the whole world about this this problem. A lot of women are kidnapped. A lot of people, you know, they get picked up on the street. So my, you know, bringing this subject is that I would like the city and the mayor to, you know, listen to me and all the women that have been homeless or that, you know, that are homeless, to say that, you know, we need our own separate place where the men are not allowed.
So Sarah, what when you were going through this experience, I mean, what would have helped you specifically? What would you like to see the city government or the state legislature do?
Well, that's what I was saying, is that all the places that I went to eat for lunch or help, like, for example, the rescue mission, there was a bunch of men that got released out of jail, and then I had to be around all these men to go to get to the women's place, and they have a separate place. But they prowl around the pimps and this opportunistic people that that want to exploit you. The Johns are there. The men that didn't have sex for a whole year are out of a jail, or rapists and domestic violence. The wife beaters and girlfriend beaters, they're down there, and the pimps are down there. And so why are they throwing the men with the women? I've been trying to talk to the counselors about the need for women-only day program, where men are not allowed to be in like a quarter mile. They're just not allowed.
Right. You know? Well, that makes sense. Sarah, thanks for your call. Janet, you've written a lot about gender differences and hunger. I mean, is this something you've looked into, the specific dangers and problems faced by women who find themselves homeless?
So, no, it's not something I've looked into, but I thought that the comments by the caller were really insightful and really interesting, an idea of a day facility for women that actually creates almost like a perimeter, because maybe Lisa could speak to this, but I would imagine that there is an association between, in some way, between domestic violence and being homeless. And so women are often come to their situation of homelessness, maybe already living in some sort of fearful situation. Is that something that's a dynamic that you see?
Yeah, I mean, I think the data supports that many women who are currently homeless are homeless because they are fleeing a domestic violence situation. So they are, like you're saying, often living in a state where they're fearful. And I appreciate what the caller had to say. I think she is right on that everyone who is homeless is very vulnerable, but women are even more vulnerable to violence and to being victims while they are living on the streets or, you know, in an unstable living situation.
Well, let's get to a few more calls before we're joined on the line by Rick Abasta from the Navajo Nation. Glenn from Hemis Springs. Hi, Glenn. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. Yes, I worked at Salvation Army Family Services in the early 1980s. And it sounds to me that this situation has not changed. At that time, St. Martin's came into being, and that's supported by the Episcopal churches and others. And I thought that their program was so better than what we were doing at Salvation Army, seeing around 50 people a day. I have a friend up here in Hemis Springs who goes to a Unitarian church that has a creative program where a few churches are part of this coalition where they will take a family one week at a time, work with them very closely, get jobs. To me, that is a really fine kind of program, and if somebody wants to call the Unitarian Church and get information, that phone would be in the phone book, I'm sure. As I listen, you know, to the news these days and think about Central American children, no language, and some of my own neighbors here in Hemis Springs are of the Republican opinion to just deport them, you know, get them out of here. I guess I'm calling for compassion with people in our communities of faith, whether mosques or churches or synagogues. If we aren't willing to have somebody in our home or be part of one of these Unitarian church kinds of programs helping, at least I would ask for compassion for our own homeless, for Central American refugee children, and to donate to churches, programs that are helping. The bucks go very fast. So I guess that's my plea to people of conscience. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Glenn. You know, there certainly is kind of an outpouring of compassion following these murders. And it's too bad that it took something like this to get this level of media attention. Of course, people like yourself, Lisa, and other organizations have been working on this issue for a long time.
Yeah, I actually wanted to respond to the first thing that the caller said, which is that not much has changed since the 80s. And that's an interesting comment because in some ways, that's true, homelessness is still with us. But I think things have actually changed a lot in that we now know what it takes to end homelessness permanently for folks. And we have a lot of very good programs that are able to do that, particularly permanent supportive housing programs that help get people into permanent housing and stay there. And even though there's been a lot of national attention around homelessness in Albuquerque, it really hasn't changed the work that our coalition and our members are doing. We're still focused on providing permanent supportive housing for folks that are homeless and trying to increase the resources available so we can provide more of that type of housing.
You know, we'll get to the housing question later. What resources are there available to the homeless? It might seem like an obvious question, but I mean, do you qualify for SNAP benefits, for food stamps, for the things that low-income Americans might have access to?
Right. There's a host of resources available. I mean, there are programs that are specifically available for folks that are currently homeless, like emergency shelters, transitional housing, and permanent supportive housing programs. But there are also programs like SNAPs, which used to be called the food stamps program, that are available just to low-income Americans generally and are also available to people that are homeless. So benefits programs like SNAPs, TANF, federal disability benefits can also be a really critical resource for people to exit homelessness or just avoid it altogether.
I did want to say, though, that the requirements for the bureaucracy that goes along with applying for many of those programs is often very challenging for people who find themselves in a homeless situation because you have to have a lot of documentation, you know, when you go and apply. So you and I probably go home and we have a file cabinet where we keep all sorts of things, records that we have. Well, if you're homeless, you don't have a file cabinet. You likely don't have a file cabinet, that you, at least not one that you can access. So that, I think, becomes a problem, is that piece of having control over your life and the information about yourself and how it goes backwards in your, you know, in your history.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, a good example are federal disability benefits. So these are programs that are only for folks with significant disabilities that are expected to last a very long time, who can't work. That is a really important resource for a lot of folks that are homeless, but extremely difficult to navigate. And in fact, nationally, the estimate is that only about 10 to 15% of folks that are homeless that would qualify for federal disability benefits are actually receiving it. One of the programs that the coalition operates is a model for helping folks who are homeless with disabilities successfully apply for federal disability benefits. So when case managers use that model, about 70% of applications are approved on initial application. So there are solutions out there, but it sort of takes specific training and techniques in order to successfully apply.
Let's go to one more phone call while we try to get the Navajo Nation on the line. Barbara in Albuquerque. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I just wanted to make the point that it's very dangerous for the homeless to sleep at night. I think that's what, you know, part of the situation that happened in Albuquerque. I mean, people were trying to sleep at night. It's very dangerous. So if you're homeless on the streets of Albuquerque, nighttime is the time to be awake, wandering, and trying to find a place to, in the winter, that's warm. Are there coffee shops that will allow you to sit in? And while you're trying to stay warm at night, because it's just not safe to sleep. So I just wanted to make that point. Thanks.
Thanks for your call, Barbara. So this is something that we've definitely been seeing in the recent weeks and months with these attacks that have been happening against homeless people. And I'm not sure how new these are. Maybe they've been going on for a while. But we had the murder of the two Navajo men sleeping in the park. Not weeks earlier than that, someone ran over a bunch of homeless people that were sleeping on the street. You know, one of the people that survived the attack against the Navajo men said that this happened in the past, but he didn't call the police because he just didn't think anyone cared. Why do we have this level of violence against homelessness? Does just the vulnerability that of sleeping on the street really explain why this happens?
I would say that it speaks to a cultural dimension of our there's a cultural dimension to it, which is, and an ideological one, which is that we tend to see people in poverty, whether they're hungry or whether they're homeless, as being somehow less of, they're not good people. They somehow have found themselves in that situation because of their own moral failings. And so once you see somebody as somehow less of a person than you are or a bad person, well, then why not do mean things to them? I mean, murder them takes it far, but even sometimes in other cities you get youth who are, you know, beating or harassing somebody. But if you don't see them as exactly human in the way, in the same way that you are, or at least as not good people, or if you see them as bad people, like, oh, they're homeless because they weren't responsible, or they, you know, were drug addicts or whatever, then you can justify in your mind, apparently, doing all sorts of things to people.
Well, this is something that our friends in the Navajo Reservation are dealing with right now. And just to recap, you know, last month, two Navajo men, Key Thompson and Allison Gordon, were beaten to death with cinder blocks and metal poles as they slept in a vacant lot in southwest Albuquerque. Police later arrested three teens for the crime. And one of those teens told police he had assaulted at least 50 homeless people in the past. And following those murders, Albuquerque Mayor Richard Berry and other officials from the city and the New Mexico legislature have been working with Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley and the Navajo Legislative Council to address problems of homelessness and violence against homeless Native Americans in our community. So we have on the line with us now Navajo Nation Communications Director Rick Abasta, calling us from Window Rock, Arizona. Hello, Rick.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Today is Navajo Code Talker Day, so big celebrations going on, and we really appreciate you taking a few minutes away from the festivities to join us. Rick, can you talk about what the reaction has been in the Navajo community to those horrendous murders that happened in Albuquerque last month?
Well, it was very shocking once the news came out about the murders. And I think a lot of the people here were just in a state of disbelief that this sort of thing would happen. And President Shelley is very thankful and appreciative of Mayor Berry and his office for reaching out and working with the nation just to address the homeless situation in Albuquerque. And what we want to do is build upon that foundation and get this out to the surrounding border towns of the Navajo Nation, cities like Farmington or Gallup or Flagstaff, and the issues that the city of Albuquerque is facing with homeless Native Americans and Navajos in particular. They also exist in those other communities. So, you know, we're looking to partner and see what kind of solutions we can come up with.
Well, the Navajo government is working in a task force with New Mexico officials to make some changes.
Yes, sir.
On that note,
task force.
What are some of the specific things you're hoping to achieve on that task force?
Well, the task force members are still being identified. We hope to have that completed by Monday. And we will share that with the mayor. And, of course, from there, we are going to be getting a budget together just to see in terms of cost.
Rick, are you there? Looks like we lost Rick. We'll try to get him back. But I'm going to go ahead and go to a break while we try to do that and get back in touch with Rick Abasta from Window Rock. You're listening to the KUNM Call-In Show live from the University of New Mexico. We're talking about homelessness in our state with Lisa Uvall, Policy and Advocacy Director at the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, and with Janet Page Reeves, Research Assistant Professor in the School of Community Health. That's the UNM Family and Community Medicine Department. Do you think elected officials are on the right track of addressing the problem? What do you think should be done to prevent acts of violence against the homeless in our community? If you want to weigh into the conversation, the number is 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866 locally. Toll free 877-899-5866 or send us an email to callinshow@KUNM.org or tweet at us, KUNM at KUNM Health. We'll be right back after a short break.
Believe it or not, it took everything from a 69 Lincoln to a Honda Goldwing to a lawn tractor. That's right, a lawn tractor to help bring you this program. If you have anything with an engine that you aren't up for the hassle and expense of fixing up and selling, call us. Most likely, we'll be able to use it to support programs like this one. Call 888-KUNM-CAR. That's 888-586-6227.
Intelligence Squared US, where the world's leading thinkers debate today's most critical issues. The next motion up for debate: individuals and organizations have a constitutional right to unlimited spending on their own political speech.
Politicians are most influenced by their ideology and by their constituents, not by donors.
Whose telephone call do they take after the election?
Sunday morning at 11 on 89.9 KUNM.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Ed Williams, reporter for Public Health New Mexico, a KUNM reporting project providing in-depth, investigative, and continuous coverage of public health and the impacts of poverty in our state. We're back on the line with Rick Abasta from the Navajo Nation. Rick?
Yes, Ed.
Sorry we lost you there. So when we lost you, you were talking about some of the specific issues that you were hoping to achieve on the task force with New Mexico officials.
We are in the process of identifying our task force members and a leader for the task force on our side, and we will be sharing that information with the mayor on Monday. From that point, we will be developing a budget to determine public outreach. We want to also increase the contribution that the Navajo Nation appropriates toward the Albuquerque Indian Center. Preliminary numbers I saw was to increase that figure from 50,000 to 100,000, and we will from that point develop some action items in conjunction with the task force members on the governor's side, I mean the mayor's side, and then we'll execute the plan. What we want to do is get together a solid game plan and bring that to the state, federal, and tribal legislators to request for some funding to address the issues that we're looking at. We have some divisions that are willing to step up to the plate, so to speak. And those divisions include the Division of Social Services, the Division of Health, in particular the Department of Behavioral Health Services, and also the Department of Workforce Development, which is under our Division of Human Resources. And President Shelley is of the opinion that we need to reach out to the homeless and provide opportunities to them so that they can make the necessary changes in their lives to get off the streets and, find a home and employment to hopefully lead to a steady life.
Rick, I met a guy while I was in Window Rock last week who said it really bothered him to hear about homeless natives because they have a home here on the reservation. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. I think just as a Navajo or a native person, and you go into the big city, even one of the local border towns, and you see these homeless people walking on the streets, it stirs you up inside, and it's a little upsetting to see that. And you think to yourself, well, where is their family? Why don't they just go home? But we don't know the particular circumstances of these individuals of, you know, why they're on the streets, but as a Navajo, you always have a home. And what we have is the concept of keh. Keh is the Navajo philosophy and lifestyle of clanship. We are all interconnected with one another through our clan system. And just on that basis alone, these folks have family that are out there. And I guess we just need to try a little bit harder to reach them and bring them back.
Thanks, Rick. Well, it was great having you on, and I know you have things to do there at the Code Talker ceremony. So we really appreciate you joining us, and thank you. Best of luck to you.
Okay, Ed. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Let's go to a few more calls. We have our lines pretty much lined up, so we want to get to as many calls as possible. Sarah, you're on the line from Albuquerque. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. So I used to be a mental health tech, actually, and I first just wanted to say that the homelessness problem is possibly never going to totally evaporate. That there are a number of people who are in a mental health situation where it's difficult for them to get out of that for life. And education also needs to be some kind of awareness campaign, needs to address the problem that you were discussing about attitudes towards homelessness, or that your speaker was discussing. And I also wanted to say, which I said before, that I strongly, not so strongly, that I'm not impressed with Barry's proposition, and I think that it's very sad that some religion has to be the one providing the care, and there ought to be public facilities where people can get safety and water and services. That it ought to be much more public thing.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
So, Lisa, I have a question that's kind of on that vein, but maybe diverging a little bit. Senator Bill O'Neill is introducing legislation to classify violence against homeless individuals as a hate crime. Do you support that? Do you think hate crime legislation could be one of the ways to try to resolve this problem?
The coalition does support Senator O'Neill's proposed legislation, which would amend the state hate crime statute to include homeless people as a protected class. You know, from the coalition's perspective, the long-term solution is to increase our investment in permanent housing, affordable permanent housing, and supports and services that help people stay housed. But that's not going to happen tomorrow. And in the meantime, we do also need to pursue strategies that help keep people safe while they are experiencing homelessness. And we feel that amending the hate crime statute is one way to try to help keep people safe who are homeless and who are sleeping outside.
Well, we have a caller that's interested in weighing in on that line of thought. Bob from Albuquerque. Hi, Bob. You're on the line.
Good morning, Ed. Good discussion. You know, this thing about Sarah called, too, about the thing of public solutions versus private or legalistic solutions. And I'm always struck by here in New Mexico, I think there's a part of an ideology here that sort of represents the whole nation towards violence, towards poor people and homeless people who don't have resources. And I always think about this thing out at Kirtland Air Force Base, housing about 3,000 nuclear weapons on a permanent basis for decades there. We spend, our politicians vote to spend hundreds of billions of dollars every year to provide shelter and maintenance and clothing for nuclear weapons, which are about violence and destruction. But yet, you know, they don't find money to take care of the programs and services and social workers that it would very easily and simply solve through a public policy program. This problem for homelessness for a lot of people who really need help and jobs and services like that. And I'm just always outraged that there's so much acceptance among the general public here of this very obvious contradiction between humans and then weapons of mass destruction and about violence, that I think it's a national problem. But I think here in New Mexico, it's created an ideology of blindness or turning the other cheek to obvious solutions and things that we ought to be speaking about. And I just saw Tom Udall's new campaign literature and ads and stuff, and he's bragging about how he's trying to get more money for these weapons labs and these military programs. And
Right. Well, Bob, we got it. That's a really good point. There is a culture of violence that tolerates homelessness, and maybe we should be reevaluating this. Janet, I see you shaking your head.
No, not shaking my head.
Not in your head.
I just wanted to say that I think that goes back to the point I think I made earlier, which was our attitude in our society, not just here in New Mexico, but we do have a particular dynamic that occurs here in New Mexico with we have a lot of poverty in the state. But I think our attitude is that people that are poor, it's their own fault, and we don't recognize the structural issues that make it often impossible for people. If you have two kids and you and your partner are working at a minimum wage job full time, you're still poor here in New Mexico. That's not going to bring you out of poverty. But if you're working full time, that makes it extremely difficult to say, do something like try to go to school and get more education so that you could improve yourself and improve, you know, to get a better job. And so what ends up happening then is people are treated as if they're lazy, as if somehow the fact that they may work full time or maybe they have two jobs, but they're still treated ideologically as if they're lazy because they're poor. It's their own fault. And so, you know, that makes it difficult for us to legislatively have any public policy that really goes beyond the bare minimum of supporting them.
Lisa?
I just wanted to say briefly, I'd like to acknowledge what the caller was saying. You know, we have this idea in our society that we're just stuck with homelessness, that it's this unsolvable problem. And we actually know what it would take to end homelessness. I mean, the programs in our community that are providing permanent housing and services to folks who have been homeless for a long time with disabilities have a 91% success rate. I mean, 91% of folks are still housed. So we know what it would take. The challenge is finding the political and community will to invest in those solutions.
Do you think now that there is some political capital now?
Yes.
Do you think that momentum is being directed in the right way?
I do. I mean, one very promising thing that's happening locally is this coming Monday, City Council will be considering a bill that would increase the gross receipts tax by 0.8% and direct that revenue into essential services for homelessness and behavioral health. I think that a year ago, that bill wouldn't have stood a chance, and now it seems like it's something that does have a chance of passing. So it does seem like there is some political will building. I also think that does seem to be an increasing understanding that there are ways to help people end their homelessness permanently. We know what the solutions are. We actually have good models here in our local community, so we don't need to start from scratch. We just need to invest in those solutions.
Jeanette is writing in with a web comment saying, calling people transients, as the media often does, dehumanizes them. The words we use to name people affects attitudes. And we have an email comment from Chris saying, people store stuff under bushes near his house. It's near a school. Makes Chris feel uncomfortable. So how to balance respect for these folks, but also our need for safety? It's probably a question that a lot of people have.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really excellent question and not one that I have an easy answer to. I mean, I know I sound like a broken record, but I will say, I mean, the real solution to this problem is to get people into housing. I mean, until folks have permanent, affordable housing and supports and services to keep that housing, they will be living outside, and that creates, you know, that's inconvenient for all of us, not to mention the person that's actually experiencing homelessness. So I really feel like that is the long-term solution. In the meantime, it is, you know, a fine balance between protecting or honoring the needs of the community and the needs of people that are experiencing homelessness that are also part of that community.
Well, housing is, you know, is one of the models that you're looking at, and it's one that you say has been really successful in the past, both economically and in terms of getting people in a better situation where they can, you know, get off the streets. But give us some more specifics. I mean, what kind of housing are you talking about? What does this entail?
So the most common model in Albuquerque and throughout the country is permanent supportive housing. It's permanent housing that's subsidized so that it's affordable to people with very low incomes, plus supportive services that can help people maintain that housing. And those supportive services ideally are very flexible so that they meet the individual needs of each person. So one individual might have a mental health diagnosis that they're dealing with. And that's where they need support. Another person might have limited education and job skills. And so where they really need support is connecting to those kind of resources so that they can get employment and maintain housing on their own. A lot of these programs are scattered site, which means that folks rent an apartment out in the community, just like any of us would do. And then part of that rent is subsidized by some form of local or some form of government, and local, state, and federal government all have housing programs. There's also models where nonprofits develop mixed income housing, which means there's a mix of folks living there at all different incomes, some of whom are previously homeless and low income. And we have some excellent examples of those in Albuquerque as well.
How many such housing units do we have right now? I mean, is there already a considerable amount that we have that we could expand upon, or is this kind of a new idea?
That's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have the exact number off the top of my head. I'm going to estimate in terms of permanent supportive housing, specifically for people that are experiencing homelessness, I would estimate there's about, I want to say about 800 units of that type of housing throughout the city. And by units, I mean not just physical units, but also vouchers that help people pay for that housing. That's a significant increase over what we had 5 or 10 years ago. So we're actually are building our supply, but it's not enough to meet the need.
And we do, you know, so 800 units, that's not a small number. Do we know how many housing units we would need? You said 17,000 people a year are homeless at some point of the year. Housing units for 17,000 people a year?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I mean, I've been talking a lot about permanent supportive housing, which is really a model for helping folks who have significant long-term disabilities and really need permanent housing assistance and services in order to maintain their housing. Not everyone who experiences homelessness needs that level of assistance in order to obtain stable housing. There's other models like rapid rehousing, which provides more short to medium-term rental assistance and services to help folks just really get into an apartment, stabilize, and then so that they can keep that apartment.
Well, we are running out of time, and I do want to get to one more phone call. I'm sorry, Janet, but Travis on the line from Albuquerque has something along those lines in terms of potential solutions. Travis, really quickly, please.
All right. I would just like to see a connection between local agricultural organizations and homeless organizations, possibly employment, where we could employ homeless people to come work at local organic farms. There's a lot of skills that they can get, and I think it'd be a great partnership. I'm executive director of an organization called Grow the Future, and we'd totally be down for a partnership like that. And I think having a job would be a very uplifting experience for people experiencing homelessness, and the skills that you gain growing food could be taken to eventually homes and things like that.
Thanks a lot, Travis. Does that sound like something that you could roll with? I mean, potential solutions to kind of accompany that, and maybe also to keep people from ending up in a situation where they need housing.
Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. I think that a lot of folks who experience homelessness would like to work, would like to be employed, or are currently employed, but would like to find a better paying, more stable source of employment. So I appreciate that suggestion and would be happy to talk with him.
Well, that's our cue. We're out of time, and I'm sorry that we are, because this is a great topic and one that definitely needs more discussion. So thanks to our guests, Lisa Uvall, Policy and Advocacy Director for the New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness, and Janet Page Reeves, Research Assistant Professor in the Office of Community Health in the UNM Family and Community Medicine Department. Also thanks to Rick Abasta of the Navajo Nation, who joined us by phone earlier in the show. If you missed part of this program or want to hear it again, you can find it and past episodes on our website, KUNM.org. We're also podcasting the show on iTunes. Thanks to Jefferson White, our engineer today. Michael Hess manages our phones. Kaveh Movahed is our assistant producer, and Elaine Baumgartel is our executive producer. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the McCune Foundation and the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. Find out more online at publichealthnm.org. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks so much for listening.